The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Good music is what we want to hear.
What do you mean, good music?
It's what we dance to, what our children will dance to. And if you don't want to play it, then take your records and go home.
Did you have a band? Good or bad?
It's a great band. It's a bad band. It's like pizza, baby. It's good no matter what. There's music in the air.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Cott. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today in the world's only rock and roll talk show, Jim and I talk to one of the true artistic visionaries in music today, Nine Inch Nails frontman Trent Reznor.
Plus, we'll review the new album from teen phenomenon, the Jonas Brothers.
Support for Sound Opinions is provided by founding sponsor Alltech Lansing and their new Octave Air speaker system, a wireless 80-watt wall of sound for your iPod. Details available at alltechlansing.com.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and now it's time for some music news.
Ah, yes, never a bad excuse to play a little bit of Minor Threat, the influential hardcore punk band from the early 80s. Why are we playing Minor Threat? Greg, they were epitomized the Washington, D.C. punk scene. And that scene in Washington is rising up to challenge the merger of Live Nation and Ticketmaster, this story we've been covering for months now. It's the biggest story in the concert industry in America today. Seth Hurwitz is a man who runs the famous 930 Rock Club in Washington, D.C. He also has a company called It's My Party that books several other pretty big venues in Washington and Maryland, including the Meriwether Post Pavilion, the big amphitheater in Columbia, Maryland. He has filed a lawsuit against Live Nation, charging the company is a monopoly, that it abuses its monopoly power, that it exercises monopoly power in 19 of the 25 largest concert markets in the United States, essentially that it is a big mafia-like bully that elbows everyone else out of the business. Hurwitz is one of the independent promoters, one of the few independent promoters left in America today, who testified on Capitol Hill before the Senate a couple of months ago in the hearings. He was joined by Jerry Michelson of Chicago's Jam Productions. Really, those are the two biggest indie guys left in the U.S. Everybody else is Live Nation in one degree or another. We are waiting for the Justice Department under President Obama to say yay or nay to this merger. But in the meantime, it appears as if there are going to be other challenges, at least from this one big D.C. indie concert promoter.
There is no doubt, Jim, that Live Nation knows it has a huge public relations problem. It's been trying to combat that this summer by offering no service fee Wednesdays. In other words, they are making select tickets available for its shows nationwide, available on Wednesdays only, without certain service fees attached. But they are removing, in some cases, double-digit dollars off of those seats, primarily lawn tickets for their amphitheater shows. So they are making an effort to try and combat the primary issues that they are facing, the biggest one being this deal with Ticketmaster, where there is no transparency on these fees. In other words, you say the ticket is $25, and then by the time you're done paying it, it's $38. Where did all those fees come from?
Well, that's the great irony. Here they are, eager to get in bed as one giant company with Ticketmaster. Ticketmaster has made itself this giant monopoly across the U.S. by inserting those service fees, and now Live Nation is trying to garner a little goodwill by getting rid of the service fee. It's like the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing, and if they're operating this way when they're still two separate companies, how much worse is it going to be when they control all of live music in America?
Woke up this morning, the house was cold. Checked the furnace, she wasn't burning. Went out and hopped in my old Ford. Hit the engine, buddy, she ain't turning. Giving each other some hard lessons lately. We ain't learning. What? The same sad story, that's a fact. One step up and two steps back.
Bruce Springsteen is emerging as one of the few artists who has actually spoken out against this Ticketmaster-Live Nation merger, Jim. He is a rarity in the business right now. But he has come into a little bit of trouble lately due to a look at the Open Public Records Act, which revealed that his recent show at the Meadowlands in East Rutherford, New Jersey, home base for the Springsteen Nation, during that particular show, more than 2,200 tickets were withheld by the Springsteen camp. 2,200 of the best seats were withheld by the Springsteen camp. Now, this is not exactly new news in a lot of ways. Springsteen and his handlers have consistently withheld prime seats for all of their stadium shows over the last couple of decades, and famously have released those tickets at the last second to the fan base, whatever is left over.
But
the
a certain number go to radio and press and friends and family.
Right. It's not like they're necessarily selling these tickets on the secondary market and profiting from them, but they are withholding them back for certain VIP guests and reserving the best sections for those people. Now, what the ticket sellers are saying is, well, by removing 2,200 tickets for a high-profile show like this from the market instantaneously, that is driving up the secondary ticket market. In other words, the scalpers are making a mint on Springsteen tickets because 2,200 of the best tickets were not even made available for sale when those tickets went on sale initially.
Look, this obviously came from the people that Springsteen is ticking off, which is Ticketmaster and Live Nation. And they're floating this. And the scalpers, right? You know, it's quite different, I think, to use automated computer programs to get an unfair advantage on the fans, to besiege the phone lines, to get these tickets, I think, illegally, and then to sell them at 10 times the face value. And it's a lot different than to have Aunt Susie come and sit, you know, because she's your guest at home when you play at home.
And you got to wonder, you know, who's planting this story as well, because at the same time that Springsteen has been so outspoken against these ticketing agencies and against the Live Nation Ticketmaster merger, we just had Ethan Smith of the Wall Street Journal on the show a few months ago, where he was talking about this is a very common practice, especially among these big stadium acts. Neil Diamond, for example, is an artist who is not only pulling tickets off the market, but it's been said that he is putting those tickets on the secondary market and actually making a profit from them. And Smith went on to say that more than half of the major stadium acts in rock and roll do this. So it's interesting that Springsteen is suddenly being singled out for a practice that has been going on for decades.
See this needle? I see my hand. Drop, dropping it down. Oh, so genuine. Oh, here it comes. I'm just a flame. Turn me up. I'll turn you away. Spin, spin. Spin the bass and hook. Spin, spin. Spin the bass, spin the bass.
Been the Black Circle indeed, Jim. Vinyl is back. We've been tracking this story for a couple of years now. Last year, a remarkable resurgence in vinyl sales, up to nearly 2 million from nothing, basically, a 90% increase in vinyl sales in 2008. Now, the first half of 2009 looks like it's surging again, another 50% increase in vinyl sales. Looks like a projected 2.8 million units by the end of 2009 in vinyl. A two-pronged effort here. Not only are vinyl addicts trying to remember their youth and buying vinyl albums as they surface, but we're seeing a resurgence among the college crowd as well. A younger audience is buying vinyl as sort of an artifact, an art form.
I thought it was fascinating when we did the record store panel for Record Store Day not long ago on this show. We had, you know, retailers, the biggest retailers in Chicago, in Austin, Texas, and in Los Angeles come in and say that they are getting waves of college kids who, you know, in the same way that a lover of literature might want to have a hardcover book, they are buying some great album that they truly love in vinyl because that's the ideal way to collect it. And many of these kids do not even have record yeah. players. I thought that was fascinating. One troubling cloud on the horizon, Greg, is that the number of vinyl pressing plants in the United States shrunk down to a mere handful as vinyl was waning, as CDs became the dominant form, to the point where many of these are backed up months and months. If you're an indie rock band, you want to press 1,000 vinyl singles, you know, you might have to wait months to get it back from the plant. If you're Radiohead and you need 2 million copies of your new album, it could be even more difficult because the vinyl plants are maxed out.
It's interesting, too, to note that even though vinyl sales are way up, you know, going to be close to 3 million by the end of this year, it's just a blip on the overall scheme of selling product in the music industry. There's, for example, 121 million CDs are going to be sold this year and about 33 million digital albums. So it is a small blip, but any news that's good for the music industry at this point is a welcome sign.
Listening to Sound Opinions, and that is the song The Beginning of the End from the album Year Zero, the 2007 release by Nine Inch Nails. Greg, Trent Reznor, who is Nine Inch Nails, has been one of the most inventive and innovative musicians in the rock world since his debut in 1989 with Pretty Hate Machine and all the way up through his last album The Slip in 2008. Nine Inch Nails records don't sound like anyone else's. He invents his own orchestra's worth of instruments and utilizes it for this genre blurring sound, you know, metal, dance, thrash, industrial, it's all of the above, and it's unique. But we are also fascinated with Trent Reznor because of the way he is attempting to remake the record industry. Year Zero in 2007 was a fascinating multimedia project. With the last couple of releases, Ghosts 1-4 and The Slip, Reznor has been reworking the distribution model, giving the music away for free on the net or selling it at different price points in different packages depending on what the fans want. Now he's looking at doing something different with touring as well, maybe getting out of the scene as Nine Inch Nails anyway. We had Reznor come by the Jim and Kay Maybe studio for a chat about all of these developments in the world of Nine Inch Nails.
Trent, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. Obviously, you've been recording since the late 80s, but I think the last 2 years, it's been a phenomenal transformation on a number of levels, both the business of being in this business and also the art. And where I'd like to start was with Year Zero, maybe the first multimedia concept album in a lot of ways. Talk a bit about the thought process that went into not only making that album, but the way you chose to release it, which was really innovative.
Well, thanks. I just kind of come out of a period of inactivity where I was working on just being human again and staying alive. The first record I did after that was With Teeth. That was me finding out if I could write sober, finding out if anyone still cared, and also reinventing or rediscovering how to write music and putting fear in its right place and realizing how much that governed pretty much everything I've done up to that point. I'm becoming less defined as days go by. And some of the mistakes I made in that was including record label advice, listening to the record label, just including them in the process a little bit. And what I learned from the process of With Teeth was that I don't really care what they think. You know? And I realized that they're, and to qualify that, there's good advice you can get in the creative process, and there's some that slant it more towards just an economic end result. And it became clear to me that the people around me in that world, the only thing they cared about was just moving plastic units. And that dawned on me about halfway through the process, and I realized what I was up to, and I got my confidence back in that. And I started working on Year Zero with a much more liberated, back-in-control feeling, and a feeling of artistic confidence that I could do anything I wanted to at this point. And I'd also learned that I actually liked to write, which I'd always feared, because writing was that stark look in the mirror, examining every pore for flaws, and I hated that process. You know, I always felt I wasn't good enough. And
you made a distinction, Trent, between writing prose and writing song lyrics?
Well, writing in general, writing lyrics, creating, the act of being in the studio, the act of writing the music, that's always been the thing that's the most difficult. And I'd always feared it. You know, I love the end result. I love the way it makes me feel when I've done something great, but I'd hate the process of mining through myself to get there. And I think getting older and getting sober, for sure, revisiting that with a different outlook, I found, much to my surprise, and I enjoyed it now.
Well, for people who don't know, I mean, 2007, Year Zero, this sprawling concept album, which, just to use the word album, limits it.
Yeah, it started out as just a frustration with the direction the country was headed and seeing if I could take Nine Inch Nails in a foreign direction of not writing about myself. And it started just as an experiment that no one would have to hear if it sucked. You know? And as it started taking shape, it was exciting enough that I thought, I'll just ride it out. And when the music got finished, that's when the next problem arose. It became very clear, which was, okay, I've written a concept record about a dystopian future place with these characters talking, not in narrative, but just snapshots of life in this time. How do I make this make sense to anybody? And there's no liner notes I could put out because there aren't any records and there aren't even any, there aren't any physical product.
We've now, lost right? The triple gatefold sleeve.
Yeah. That's when it took an interesting turn and got the most exciting to me. We started thinking about how we could utilize the web or the way people communicate now and be able to introduce the experience of this record and take it beyond just being a couple-page synopsis of backstory that the music's supposed to be set in and make it more of an experiential situation. And we thought about a campaign that really impressed us both, which was the movie AI, the way it was marketed, Kubrick's last thing. You know, if you looked at the movie poster and you saw credit for sentient robot programming, you know, and if you Google that name, you came up with a website that tied into this whole kind of insanely detailed world that set a backdrop for the actual movie and blurred it. It took the movie off the screen a bit, spilled over the edges of it. And I like the idea of how do we make this feel like it exists? And how do we let people discover it? And it's not about trying to market a record, because this is as much the art as the record is, if not more
sure,
so.
Sure. You know?
And ended up just spending the record budget on that part of it, basically. And we pulled off something that I think was unique and interesting and fully utilized the medium that people communicate in today and used it as an art form. And I feel very proud of how that whole thing came out. It was a fun process.
Some say it was a warning. Some say it was a sign. I was standing right there when it came down from the sky.
Coming Coming up next on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, we continue our frank discussion with Nine Inch Nails leader Trent Reznor. Later on, we're going to review the new album from the Jonas Brothers.
Said it was up to us. Up to us to decide. You've become violent.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. Jim and I are going to continue our conversation with Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails. You know, Reznor made headlines in 2007 at a concert in Australia when he lashed out against his former record company Interscope for inflating the price of his album, Year Zero.
Now, remember, last time I was here, I was doing a lot of complaining about the ridiculous prices of CDs down here. And that story got picked up and got carried all around the world, and now my record label all around the world hates me. I didn't get a chance to check. Has the price come down at all? Okay. Well, you know what that means. Steal it.
Trent Reznor with a huge YouTube hit, going up in front of a crowd of people saying, steal my stuff. What was going on at that moment, Trent?
You'd like your audience to be on your side. And it's frustrating when, as record labels have fallen upon hard times, they're only concerned still about their bottom line. You see it in their strategy of dealing with the internet or their lack of strategy. The concept of suing fans for stealing music, you know, they're stealing it not to make money from it. They're stealing it because they love it and they want it. Mm-hmm. How do you capitalize upon that instead of punish people, you know? And we're disproportionately big in the U.S. versus the rest of the world. So when we talk about taking a full production down to play Australia, where it costs a lot of money to get it there, and you're concerned about ticket prices, and you walk into a record shop and you see your record that came out the same day as 10 other bands, and it's 50% more than everyone else. Mm. And then you ask someone at the label, why is that? You know, we're trying to compete. Well, because you have a strong fan base, we could charge anything we want. You know, I applaud his honesty to me. But that doesn't leave a good taste in the fan's mouth. And I'm not making that extra money. And that would be something I wouldn't agree with anyway, but that's a conversation at least. But you're saying you're going to scalp my fans because you can. Well, you know.
Yeah.
Just censored myself there, but you get the idea.
You're an ardent student of rock history, Trent. I mean, isn't it absurd? You know, we all know about that famous battle Tom Petty had about CD pricing 30 years ago, and then a mere 3 or 4 years ago, the battle's still there. It's like, you know, the record industry never learns, does it?
What feels different to me, you know, as someone that got signed in 89 and then got signed to a major in early 90s, the climate then felt a lot more like there were people that loved music that worked at record labels. And the story that you would hear was, we're looking at a career artist. You know, they'd drop names of bands you respected, The Cure, Depeche Mode, bands that, you know, five records in were breaking even in a fan base. And those are the things that if you're an act like myself, you want to hear and you want to believe that people are out and you want to believe, and I did believe, that there was a balance between art and commerce, and they realized they were selling art to make money from it, but there still was an artistic value to things. By the late 90s, now all those independent record labels, all the cool indies have been bought up by majors, all the big majors have been sold to corporations. Interscope was sold to Universal, Universal sold to Vivendi, a French garbage company. You know, so the guy that used to be able to say, yeah, let's go do that, that was above you at the record label, now has to answer to an accountant who's just looking at quarterly profits. And pretty soon you start getting shuffled into the irritating artist category, you know. And labels have been trying everything they can to remove the artist from the equation. I mean, look at something like the Pussycat Dolls. It's manufactured from the ground up as product.
Each one replaceable.
And there's nothing wrong with product, but when it crowds out the art, then it does feel like it's the wrong thing.
You went indie soon after that statement. I guess it was
weird how that happened.
And I meant really indie. I mean indie. Like, you became your own record company. You're basically your own mini record industry. Was that a daunting prospect? I mean, obviously the history with the labels hadn't been the best. But then again, doing it all yourself, that's a kind of a daunting thing as well. What led you to believe that you could do it at that level?
Well, I have a smart manager, and when we finally were freed from Interscope, you know, it was 5 minutes of celebration, and then, uh-oh.
Yeah, what do we do now?
Yeah, our bluff was very much called, because it's very easy when you're on a label to see what they're doing wrong. But there isn't it wasn't clear then, and it isn't completely clear now even, what the right thing to do without that infrastructure is. You're then left with the choice of, well, do we look for a little indie distributor or a cool indie label? But it seemed like we thought, let's just bypass all of it and just see if we can do everything ourselves. A couple years into it now, I've been able to look at actual numbers. And it has worked out in our case that we're substantially ahead, having done it completely ourselves, than if we would have gone with distributors we could have gone through. The intangibles, though, and these are the things that will catch up to the other bands that are behind me in terms of doing this on your own, are when you are completely on your own, suddenly there's no other pocket you can reach in to get money for. Mm-hmm. And things like, oh, yeah, we need a publicist, right? Yeah. How much is a phone? Okay. Well, we do need that. Okay. Do we need a radio promo? I don't know. Do we need a radio promo guy? Do we get played on the radio anymore? Do we need a street team? And I don't know what that does, but there was 20 people in Interscope that seemed to do something with M&M posters behind them.
Right.
So you end up not paying for some of those things. And you also end up spending a lot more time thinking about stuff that isn't music, marketing, presentation. How do we gain the respect of fans to where they feel good about supporting what I do without them feeling ripped off in a climate where they feel all music should be free and they're right to feel that way? I spent a lot of time just not making music, trying to solve this problem. And through trial and error, I think for Nine Inch Nails, we've discovered some things that work. It's not universal. It doesn't work for a brand new band. I know that. I'm working on it.
In a lot of ways, the most remarkable story in 2008. I mean, first of all, the output, artistic output. I think you released in that time the equal of the previous 15 years on labels. I mean, you put out five separate discs of music, including a box set of instrumental music. Beautiful stuff. Huge range of art there. Never got played on radio, as you said. Never got no video to speak of. No sound scan numbers. And yet, in 1 week, you were by far the biggest selling artist in the United States. And the PR campaign was brilliant. A sentence on your website. That was it. I mean, and
cheap.
Then you get this response, 700,000 orders in a week. You know, you were transparent about the numbers, $1.6 million. That was a huge risk, and yet it paid off incredibly well.
It was the concept work. Give it away digitally, because it is free anyway. You know, to those artists that don't want to believe it, believe it. You know?
Yeah.
Anything, once we move to CDs, you now sell software. Software is not secure. Don't fight it. Embrace it. And you want people to have your music. You know, I do.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So if we can find a way to make a reasonable amount of profit to cover the costs, and we can get it in as many people's hands and heads as possible, and you become a champion with the fan rather than a tormentor or someone trying to rip them off, you know, seemed like it worked. You know?
Have you seen any fall off, Trent, in the concert attendance? Because, I mean, you know, clearly if artists are giving their records away or allowing people to download them and pay something if they want, but you know, that revenue stream having been gone, the way you're going to pay your rent is by still coming. You're performing in Chicago tonight.
Yeah.
Is that still vital and vibrant for you?
In total honesty, you know, we toured a lot in arenas last year. And our spring tour went on sale and gas prices were the highest they'd ever been. Mm. And attendance was 80% of what we'd hoped for. Our fall tour went on when the banks all collapsed. I think we went on sale that day. And we were 20% down from where we thought. Yeah. And these were in the North Dakotas and playing half full arenas in winter and feeling like, maybe this is it. Is this how it ends? You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When we decided to make this our last tour, the attendance on this one has been almost double what we expected, you know, and that's not bravado, it's just reality. Yeah. We're selling out amphitheaters, and it feels great, you know, and I'm sure a lot of that has to do with Jane's addiction. A lot of it has to do with me hyping it up as the final tour, I would imagine.
As a fan of Nine Inch Nails for 20 years, I suppose I should know by now to, you know, accept what you say as fact. But I did not believe this last tour thing until you just said it twice.
Here's what it comes down to, quite honestly. Is like, I mean, laying it on the table from a monetary position, in 2005, I was broke. And I was in a lawsuit with my ex-manager. That got resolved, and touring the last few years, I'm in a place where I feel okay, and power's not going to get shut off tomorrow. But I've watched the pages of the calendar kind of fly off, and oh, I'm back here again, and I'm on tour, and I'm playing the same songs. And I feel like artistically the best thing for me to do is break this while it still is in a good place. I'm not going to quit making music, and it may or may not be under the name Nine Inch Nails in the next bit of time. But the idea of taking Nine Inch Nails back on the road and doing the same thing, I feel like it's running its course right now. And I want to feel like right now I feel pretty powerful on stage and I feel relevant and I feel like I'm in sync. And I don't want it to become Gene Simmons putting on his, you know, demon boots.
It's funny you say that because Jim and I were talking just before you got here about this whole notion of what happened to that, you know, that amazing group of artists that came up in the early 90s, you know, including yourself, including Jane's Addiction that you're touring with now. You're probably the one guy that we can both agree on that said, you know, here you are 20 years later and, you know, you don't
doing
feel
the same old crap.
Well, you don't feel like it's a nostalgia show. And I think, you know, I just want to hit you up with this one little... There's all sorts of net buzz about the Twitter that you wrote about Chris Cornell.
Yeah.
And justifiably tweaking him for making a terrible record.
We didn't like that album either.
But you kind of wonder what happened.
Oh, that was the worst review we've given in Sound Opinions history, I think.
Yeah, that was off the charts. Everybody out on my blood. Everybody want my percent. I don't want to stop going off. I don't want to stop talking shit. Just want to take what is mine. How much more can you get?
Now, I'll tell you what I think it is from first-hand experience, when you get a degree of fame, it's character distorting. And I can't speak for other peers at the time, but you see fame twisting them into different entities. And some people just change into maybe they weren't that good in the first place, or maybe what was good about them doesn't exist anymore. I don't know. In the case of Cornell, I don't know Chris, you know, and I do know what label he's on now, and I do know who's whispering in his ear.
Interscope, that would be your former.
And heavily on the With Teeth album. I turned that record in, and I would get back, hey, you know, you might want to, maybe we need to put some beats on this record. I'm not making this up. What do you mean, beats? Well, this urban thing is really taking off. Yeah. You get it in the club. You know, what if we had Dre or somebody? And the part of me that wants to be the open-minded artist says, I'll consider that. You know, and it went as far as Timberland trying to do a remix at Interscope's dime of Hand That Feeds, which was laughably terrible. And when I turned in Year Zero, which I thought had the coolest beats I've ever come up with, and I hear, you know, we need some cool beats. It's like, you know what? Fuck me.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And I'm sure there was someone whispering in Cornell's thing, and he can put that off as some kind of socio-cultural experiment. But what it was a money grab.
Yeah.
And when you do that,
that failed.
You're saying to other people that look up to you,
yeah,
it's okay to do that. And it's not okay to do that. Yeah. It isn't. That's how I feel about it. And
well,
he gave us
something historic. I mean, it is one of the worst albums of all time, and that's a real accomplishment.
Well, and then
impressively bad.
That Brian Eno cliche about the Velvet Underground, that they didn't sell a lot of albums in their time, but everyone who bought one went out and started a band.
Yeah.
You know, it seems to me that the legacy of art you've created as Nine Inch Nails has that kind of influence. You know, you have literally created a sonic palette that's all your own. I mean, the thrill for me in listening to each record is it's always difficult to find a guitar that sounds like a guitar. I think you've taken it to the next level.
I'm flattered. I can't say that I can agree with everything you're saying, but I appreciate you saying
it. You know, it's not just blowing smoke up your butt. Part of it is any time I talk to anyone who uses, you know, a sampler, a drum machine, or a synthesizer, at some point Nine Inch Nails comes up.
Well, and it also points out, a record like The Fragile, which I think is one of the best records of the last 20 years that anybody's made, and I remember talking to you at that time, and you were very disappointed in the fact that nobody seemed to even know that record existed. And you think, well, what if that record had come out in 1977 or 1967? It would have blown people's minds. But I think Jim's right, that record is the same kind of thing. It's like, maybe it didn't sell a lot, but people still listen to that record today. It still holds up. It's one of those records people go to, oh my God, how do you do that? Have enough distance and perspective on it to say that's worthwhile to me now?
No,
from that standpoint?
I always loved that record. It was, I think when you would have talked to me, it was in the major stings of realizing what I'd mentioned earlier, where the transition from labels, of going from helping sell your art to people. Now it's just product, and what is this weird thing you've given us? That was when Interscope really showed their true colors, and that was a painful process to be on a tour to find out, hey, your masterpiece has just been left to, you know, sorry it wasn't, it's not Eminem's 50 Cent's new record, so it's not good. And to some degree, I think that with what you're seeing happening in the way people are experiencing music now, it is, I think, more difficult to keep people's attention and to the nature of collecting music and to the super fanatic that your record leaked and they immediately want to get it. You know, and I got it before you did. Did you get the record? Yeah. And I've already said, it's great or it sucks. And what's the next one? Because my iPod needs to be filled up with stuff and I haven't even listened to all the stuff I have. And it's sometimes frustrating to look in terms of making a full-length album that's taken X amount of time to do and it's consumed so quickly that no one spends time with it anymore.
Well, there was nothing disposable about that sound, though, that Jim was talking about. And, you know, in a lot of ways, when you came out in the late 80s, it was innovative. It was like, wow, this is rock, but it doesn't sound like traditional rock instruments being used. Where did those ideas come from? I mean, obviously, you're combining an element of avant-garde with, you know, the hardest edge of punk and doing something that was your own.
But always melodic.
Yeah.
You know, I think what it was the look through the eyes of somebody that plays keyboards and likes electronics and had just discovered the power of breaking those electronics and being able to incorporate some of the aggression and noise of from heavy metal to traditional industrial electronic experimental things. That was my sonic toolkit. Not having a band that had a sound, when it came time to put things together, okay, I can, you know, I used Prince as an influence, and it's flattering to hear what you said earlier, because I'd always aspired to have, it sounds like, you know, you could tell if he's playing guitar, you could tell if it's his drum programming, and wow, it's all coming out of one guy. I wish I could have that kind of identity. So as the kind of guy mixing everything together with that influence, when I started writing music, as much as I wanted to be Genesis P. Orridge and the edgiest, freakiest, weirdest avant-garde mind in the world, I'd grown up on 18 years of living in a cornfield in Pennsylvania with AM radio and Foreigner records and, you know, choruses and melodies and structure that had become kind of embedded, you know. And when I'd listen to some things, what I'd miss about in a Throbbing Gristle track would be some tangible element you could come back to, you know, mm-hmm. a chorus of some sort, you know, something. It doesn't have to be a Beatlesque hook in there, but something that made it emotionally feel gratifying.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting too. This stuff was happening in the Midwest because there was also the Wax Trax thing and Ministry and all that. How did that factor in at all to what you were doing?
The whole Wax Trax scene was a huge influence, and that would have been the number one place we would have wanted to wind up, you know, because it was a lot of what Jorgensen was doing seemed wildly exciting to me because it was the kind of thing I was interested in, you know, sequencers and synthesizers, but they didn't sound like Human League. You know, it sounded like people that broke them somehow, and they sounded terrifying, and I'd never heard things like that. And it excited me that it didn't feel retro. This felt like new technology coming into play, and I was right there when sequencers became affordable and could run on a Commodore 64 with a cartridge in the back, and you know, it became a tool that became my band.
Yeah,
you've talked about this on stage before. You've mentioned it in interviews, but I do. Is your mind still blown that Johnny Cash covered your song?
No, it still seems weird. You know, it is weird. You know, it's very flattering from a songwriting perspective, you know, to have somebody who is a great songwriter asked to cover your song and then weirdly turn probably the most personal song I've written into something that isn't yours anymore. It was a strange thing to witness. And I don't feel like I had much to do with it other than weirdly feel flattered through the whole process. And you know.
Right. But I mean, when all is said and done, that's something that's in your tombstone. On your tombstone and your obit, you know, Johnny Cash took a song by mine and made it into a masterpiece.
Yeah, and it made me legitimate where I came from. So, yeah. You know, well, you the guy that did that, Johnny Cash?
Let me buy you a beer.
I think what it also pointed out, and it certainly clarified for me, you're a songwriter. I mean, people talk about the sound, but there's songs underneath that sound that are holding up.
I'm trying to keep that under the line. Let's move on.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real.
Trent Reznor, it's been a pleasure having you on Sound Opinions. Thanks for coming in.
Flattered to be here. Thanks for having me.
The old familiar sting, try to kill it all away, but I remember everything.
If you want to comment on our conversation with Trent Reznor or share any of your critical opinions, give us a call at 888-859-1800. We're going to be back in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media with our review of the new album from teen sensations, the Jonas Brothers.
Goes away in the end, and you could have it all. My empire of dirt, I wear this crown of thorns upon my liar's chair, full of broken thoughts I cannot repair. Beneath the stains of time, the feelings disappear. You are someone else. I am still right here. What have I become? My sweetest friend. Everyone I know.
Support for Sound Opinions is provided by founding sponsor Alltech Lansing and their new Octave Air speaker system, a wireless 80-watt wall of sound for your iPod. Details available at alltechlansing.com.
I make the most of all the stress. I try to live without regrets, but I'm about to break a sweat. I'm freaking out. It's like a poison in my brain. It's like a fog that blurs the scene. It's like a vine you can't untangle. I'm freaking out. Every time I turn around, something don't feel right. Might be paranoid.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. That is a song called Paranoid, one of the first singles from the new Jonas Brothers album, Lines, Vines, and Trying Times. Who are the Jonas Brothers and why are we talking about them on Sound Opinions? Well, they are nothing less than the reigning pop phenom of the moment. Created by Disney, pushed by Hollywood Records. But Greg, you know, these are harrowing financial times. And I think like every major American corporation, these well-coiffed brothers from Wyckoff, New Jersey, are facing a challenge in staying connected and profitable with their marketplace. This is the fourth album for the Jonas Brothers. And they've already had two go-rounds on the merry-go-round. You know, they had a career where they were signed to Columbia Records in mid-decade, didn't sell, and were dropped. They thought it was done then, before the mouse, Hollywood, picked them up, made them superstars. Now, their fan base of 9 to 13-year-old girls is getting older. They're graduating from Harry Potter to the Twilight series, okay? How do the Jonases stay relevant? Well, these three guys who write their own songs, allegedly, and, you know, record their own music and sing and look pretty, they did a charity gig with Neil Diamond earlier this year. And they were inspired on this fourth album to kind of go diamond. They wanted to expand. They wanted to mature. They know their audience is getting older. They wanted to keep up. So they brought in the horns. They brought in the orchestras. They brought in the stylistic dabbling. Is it an artistic success? Well, we'll give our opinion in a minute and rate it on the buy it, burn it, trash it scale. But let's play a piece of Jonas Brothers art, shall we? This is called World War III by the Jonas Brothers from Lines, Vines, and Trying Times.
I walked into the bedroom. You are visibly upset. Telling me I'm in a bad mood. But I didn't do nothing. And you start screaming, wake the neighbors. Now everybody's out for blood. I didn't want no confrontation. No, you can't have a World War III if there's only one fight but it. If you know, whoa, that there's lessons left to learn. Every time you attack, doesn't drive me to fight you back. And then I know, whoa, that I'll never let it be World War III. World War III. Let me tell them. Troops on me. I tell a lie just to feel happy. But I won't retaliate. Nah. No, you can't have a World War III if there's only one side fighting. If you know, whoa, let the senses live to learn. Every time you attack, doesn't drive me to fight you back. And I know, whoa, that I'll never let it be. World War III.
That's World War III on Sound Opinions from Lines, Vines, and Trying Times, the fourth studio album from the Jonas Brothers. Quite prolific. Kevin's only 21, Joe's 19, Nick is all of 16. They've already got four studio albums out. That's a career in itself right there. And in that song, World War III, you hear everything that's going on in this album, the new developments in the Jonas Brothers camp. You know, notice those bigger soul orchestrations, the yep. horns. You notice the vocals. He's sort of straining for that falsetto, faux soul, Motown sound. And you've got the lyrics. They're now speaking in metaphors. Forget about the puppy love pronouncements. It's now a metaphorical. World War III is breaking out in our bedroom, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and there's also the one where love, you know, Greg, is like poison ivy.
It is. It's like poison ivy.
It's a rash.
There are many songs that are symbolic in nature on this record. Sophistication. They're becoming adults. You know, you mentioned the Neil Diamond connection earlier, Jim, but I thought the real sign of where this record was going was when they did that collaboration with Stevie Wonder at the Grammy Awards back in February. And right away, I'm going, wow, what's wrong with this picture? Stevie Wonder tolerating these three bozos up there on stage.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't particularly love or hate these guys. I think they're fine for what they are. I thought the last album was a nice little power pop record in a kind of a juvenile way, a stepping stone record for these teenage girls you were talking about. But on this record, they're trying to grow up, and clearly they're not ready for it. The one saving grace of their earlier records was that they were sort of peppy and energetic and exuberant, and they really weren't pretending to be anything more than they really were. On this record, they're striving for a sophistication in the lyrics and the arrangements that are just ponderous. I mean, they don't sound very good anymore. The songs are not there anymore, and that was their only calling card. Well, at least it's a nice, pleasant, guilty pleasure. You can't even say that about these guys anymore.
No, they were aiming for Neil Diamond, and they wound up with Wayne Newton. Diamond can laugh at himself, and these guys have no sense of humor whatsoever. You said you could take them or leave them. I actively hate them.
I know you do, yeah.
Because I think that there is an element of sexism here. While they talk a lot about their chastity and how they're saving themselves, they're also talking nonstop about frustration. They're taking pot shots at former girlfriends, you know, Miley Cyrus and Taylor Swift. And it's like these bozos should just go away.
These are all platonic relationships, Jim. You're missing the boat.
Frustrated about? You know, they're talking about this itch they cannot scratch in Poison Ivy. In the past it was merely annoying, and now it's pretentious and annoying. This is absolutely a trash it record. I would take two copies and trash them both.
Well, I'm not nearly as outraged as you are, Jim, but yeah, it's a bad record. It's not very enjoyable. It's a trash it.
Well, we hope to have more enjoyable music on the show next week. What is coming up, Mr. Cotton?
I guarantee we will have more enjoyable music next week, Jim. We have chef, author, and punk rocker Anthony Bourdain to talk about the intersection of food and music.
Greg, as always, we have some thank yous to say. Mary Gaffney recorded our conversation with Trent Reznor, and Sound Opinions was produced by our ace team of Todd Bachman, Jason Saldana, and Robin Lynn, the latter two of whom got married this weekend. How about that? And our executive producer, our fearless leader, Tori Southside Malatia, is our man, despite the fact that he spends an inordinate amount of time trying to get his hair to look like Joe Jonas's.
Busy every time that I phone. Bus is the longest talker I ever known. Bus, bus, I've been trying hard to reach him all day. Bus, when I get him, I forget what to say.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. Now it's time to hear what you have to say.
Bus, bus, I've decided that this romance is true. Can it be true that it is ringing? I can believe it. Where shall I say hello?
New messages.
Hi guys, this is Courtney calling from Brooklyn, New York. I was just catching up on the podcast, and I was so pleased to hear you acknowledging what Nine Inch Nails are doing to raise money for Eric De La Cruz. And these days, we've been hearing so much about how Ticketmaster and Live Nation and the artists themselves are gouging their fans and lining their own pockets with their special VIP packages and auctions and stuff. But seeing Trent Reznor using his fame, not only to think creatively about music and marketing and technology, but also about how to help people on a basic and meaningful level. That makes me really proud to be a fan. So thanks for letting people know about that, and I love the show, so keep up the good work.
Hello, my name is Paul. I just want to say thank you for putting Steve Earle on the air. I'm just listening to your show about Towns Van Zandt. Steve Earle himself is such a good storyteller, songwriter. The way he speaks, his turns of phrase are so good to hear. There's just this connection between people like him and people like Mark Twain. It's all part of what is best about this country's contribution to the world and music and literature and everything. Take care. Bye-bye.
You're soft as glass. I'm a gentle man. We got the sky to talk about and the earth to lie upon.
Hi, yeah, my name's Ronnie. I live in a cultural cul-de-sac down here in Lincoln County. It's a county seat, Stamford, Kentucky. I was just calling about your show on Towns Van Zandt. And thanks to Steve Earle for putting this album out. It's like going to be my favorite album this summer, I think. Towns, and we miss you, man.
Nothing is too much to bear. Where you've been is good and gone. All you keep getting the list to fly, oh, so shake the dust off of your wings and the sleep out of your eyes.
Hey guys, Travis here from Birmingham, Alabama, and on your buy it, burn it, trash it scale, let me tell you what I don't buy, and that is your review of the new Dave Matthews record. Jim, you clearly detested this record, and yet you gave it a burn-it rating. And Greg, I didn't sound like you were that excited about it either. And you gave it a buy-it, and I'm just trying to figure out the reasons for that. I don't know if you feel pressured from the fans, or maybe it's the difference between trying to provide objective criticism, even if you're not crazy about a particular record. At any rate, based on that song that you played for us, I won't be buying Dave Matthews' record anytime soon. Sound like a noisy classroom of undisciplined fifth graders to me. So thanks for the warning. And thanks for the show. I always enjoy it. Bye.
Hey, this is Jeff from Raleigh calling about the new Black Eyed Peas album.
and I just wanted to express my disappointment that Party All the Time isn't a cover of the song Eddie Murphy did with Rick James in the mid-'80s. I think we all can agree that would have been really funny. But hey, thanks for the show. It's always a pleasure.
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on sound opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with sound opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.